So I have these friends who believe in God and Jesus and the whole thing. And it works for them, and that's great. See, they know, though, that I'm on the fence about a lot of it, so they try to tell me about what they believe. And if I'm honest, parts of it sound really good. But what about
have you ever wondered why you agreed to do something? Maybe your boss gave you a project. It wasn't due for months, and now it's due next week, and you're thinking in your heart, why did I ever say I would do this? Maybe you told a friend that you would help them organize a party later in the year, and now it's getting very close, and you wonder, why did I ever agree to do this in the first place? I have a picture that perfectly illustrates this. These are men that went shopping with their wives, sitting on a bench, wondering in their hearts, why did I tell her I would do this? Honestly, that's how I feel right about now. I had sent out a request that you would maybe share with me some of your questions, some of difficult faith questions that you have. And you responded. I did it on Facebook as well. I had people responding privately, responding, you know, openly. But I was given some very difficult questions. And some of them really challenged me as I read them. And I kind of feel like I should start with an apology as we launch into this new series. For one thing, I cannot answer every question. I took six that were asked multiple times, and those questions will be our focus for this series. But I have to admit right out the gate, I feel inadequate. The questions that we're going to explore are... And I'm not sure that faith and certainty can always coexist well together. If you have all of it figured out and you can completely see it, then you are not walking by faith anymore. You are walking by sight. And you say, well, that makes faith sound really hard. Because faith is hard. You see, real faith is a real struggle. Some people make faith look easy, but I am of the conviction that easy faith is most likely untested faith. The people that I know who have a faith that cannot be shaken are people that went through a time in their life that their faith was indeed shaken. Because life is really hard experiences and questions at you, and faith will get challenged. In fact, I don't believe that authentic doubt makes your faith inauthentic. In other words, the presence of faith does not mean the absence of doubt. For example, when Jesus was about to ascend into heaven, he was about to give the Great Commission, and it says in Matthew chapter 28, verse 17, when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Can you do that at the same time? Can you worship God and doubt? We do it every week. We praise Jesus, and yet in our mind there is sometimes a whisper, God, why would you allow so much suffering in this world? God, why is there so much killing and violence in the Bible? Maybe even more pertinent, God, why didn't you show up when I needed you most? You see, I think we all have a, but what about? In fact, I think it is okay to have those kinds of questions because God doesn't want to be loved just with our hearts. He said, I want you to love me with all of your mind. God doesn't want us to turn our brain off with Jesus just to follow him. And besides, does ignoring those questions make them go away? You see, a doubter is not the same as a non-believer. The word doubt in the Bible literally means double stand. I have one foot here, and I have one foot here, and it's like in my mind I'm going back and forth, and I'm trying to decide where it is I'm going to land. To doubt is to wrestle, and wrestling can make you stronger. There is this awesome story in the Gospels. This father loved his son. His son was very sick. In fact, it says that his sickness was due to a demon, and the disciples of Jesus were not able to help. And so the father says to Jesus, if you can do anything, please help. If I can, Jesus replied, all things are possible for him who believes. And then that dad, he prays what I think is one of the most rawest and one of the bravest prayers in the Bible. Mark chapter 9, verse 24, immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. Maybe you don't have any but whatabouts. Maybe you don't even understand people who have doubts. And maybe this series is just not going to speak to you. But I know from the questions that I received that there are a lot of people that worship every single week and they wrestle with God. And if that's not you, then maybe what is going to be shared will help you to have conversations with people who do have doubts. What I am hoping is not that I can answer all of the questions that you have. Tidy little packages. What I'm hoping is that I can help you decide to not give up on God. Because when you give up on God, I think you give up a lot more than you realize. Ideas have consequences. And it's easy to think, well, if I get rid of my faith struggle, I can get rid of it by just getting rid of God. Well, I want to spend a little time today, and I just want to plow through some ground. What kind of world do we create if we get rid of doubts by deciding to not believe in God? Well, here's one thing you need to write this down. No God results in a world of no meaning. It is intellectually dishonest to say that life has meaning if we live in a meaningless universe where we are simply cosmic accidents. Few philosophers in the last century had more impact on our universities and academia than Bertrand Russell, an atheist, a rabid atheist from England. And here's what he said. In this whole universe, the Milky Way is just a little fragment. And inside that fragment, our solar system is just a little speck. And inside that speck, there is a tiny little dot that we call Earth. And on this dot, these lumps of carbon and water crawl around. We call them people. They crawl around for a few years until they dissolve into the elements of which they were compounded. That's the real universe. How do you find meaning if that's how you view life? To have meaning, you have to feel like your life is making a difference. But the dominant worldview today says the universe says you don't make a difference. You don't matter. You are not supposed to be here. You're just a fluke, a lump of carbon and water. You came and you're going to disappear and it's never going to matter. So how can you live with that? Well, the only way you can is to not think about the ultimate consequence of your worldview. Just grab all the happiness that you can right in the particular moment you're in, because that is the whole point of history. And the problem there is that life doesn't let you control moments. So you despair a lot. And ultimately, you become very cynical. Now, you take the Christian who deals with a hard life, and the Christian can think, but this life is not the only life. And the little I do that is good is going to have an eternal reward. The Christian can deal with life by thinking about the consequence of his worldview. The unbeliever has to not think. It is not true that Christians have to turn off their brains. We survive by using our brains. A Christian author wrote in sarcasm, "Once I learned that there's no God or life after death, it changed my life. The law of natural selection has set me free from my addiction, and random chance has made my life more brave, more purposeful, more meaningful." You can push back and you can say, "I don't need God to have meaning. I'll create my own meaning. I will find meaning by being a good parent. I will find meaning by creating great music. I will find meaning by helping the poor." Okay, but let's be honest. The universe doesn't agree with you. The universe doesn't care whether you are a good dad or a jerk. Your meaning is irrelevant, and in a society of created meanings, how do we ever even find justice? Think about it. You find meaning by helping the poor. Well, I find meaning by being as rich as I can, and I don't care if the poor are exploited if it means that I get more stuff in my garage. How can you say that your meaning is better than my meaning if we all create our own meanings? You see, you don't just lose meaning when you get rid of God. No God results in a world of no morals. Secularism can tell me what life is. What it cannot do to you or me is tell you what life ought to be. I'm not saying that if you don't believe in God, you're a bad person. You may be a very moral person. You may have very moral feelings. But what I am saying is you cannot promote moral obligation. You cannot say that what you think is right and everybody else has to agree with it. Richard Taylor is a very well-known ethicist. He's not, by the way, a believer in God. I want you to hear what he says. He says, "To say that something is wrong because it is forbidden by God is perfectly understandable. But to say something is wrong when there is no God to forbid that, it's not understandable. The concept of moral obligation is unintelligible apart from the idea of a God." You see, the morality of secularism is authorizing. I will decide for myself what is right or what is wrong. And here's the problem. You decide it's right for me to be faithful to my wife. Well, I decide what makes me really happy is to have sex with as many people as I can, maybe even with your wife. How can you say I'm wrong if we make up our own morals? I want you to think about this with respect to the single greatest question that I think challenges faith. It is the question that I got multiple times more than any other, and here it is. If God is so good, and why is there so much bad in this world? Why is there so much injustice? Why is there so much pain? Why is there so much suffering? And that is a very hard question, and we're going to dive deep into that next week. But I just want to splash a little bit on this right now. Because if that's where you are and that is what you're thinking about, if you're thinking, well, I'm going to give up on God because of all of the injustice in this world, then I want to ask you a question. When you get rid of God, did the world become more just? And are you going to hold on to your idea of injustice? In a world without God, why would you expect justice? How does the concept of justice fit in a survival of the fittest worldview? Have you ever put an animal on trial? When a big animal attacks and kills a little animal for food or resources, is that wrong? It's doing what we would label as natural. So why is it not natural for more highly evolved lumps of carbon and water to live in the same manner? In other words, exploitation and self-interest should be expected if we live in a world where humans have only ascribed value. In other words, they are only worth what they can produce and what they can do for us. And by the way, that is the world that we live in today. That is the dominant worldview. New Yorker Magazine and New England Journal of Medicine says that the single most influential philosopher in America right now in terms of affecting what we feel about behavior is a man named Pete Singer from Princeton University. And just recently he argued that we should not consider babies truly alive for the first 28 days. And this will give the parents time to decide if allowing the child to stay alive will bring the most happiness to the family. He argues, for example, if a child is born with severe hemophilia, that is going to be a burden on that family. And while that child may still produce some measure of happiness, what if ending the life of that child and having a second child that was healthy would produce more happiness? Isn't that a higher good? Isn't that actually a better world? Therefore, it's not wrong to not just let the child die. It's not wrong to kill the child. And you say, our society would never feel that way. Our society already thinks this way. We have already decided that we can kill the baby before it is born, and now we have decided once it is born from a botched abortion, there is nothing wrong with just setting it aside on a counter to die. You see, that will make somebody happier. That's why we would do something like that. I go up to the Capitol building every single legislative session to jump into the ongoing discussion of at what point you can kill an elderly person or someone who is terminally ill, because those folks are a burden. We already think this way. Have you ever seen in history a single society where the decrease of religious faith produced an increase in the value of human life? Do you know where the idea of intrinsic value comes from? That is a Bible idea. That is a Judeo-Christian ethic. Nobody in the ancient world thought that every single person is equal. Women were property. Slaves were barely human. And if you wanted a boy and your wife gave birth to a girl and you didn't want to keep her, you threw that child into the dump. It was the Judeo-Christian ethic that said, no! Slaves are equal to their masters. Women are equal to men. It was the Christian that went to the dump and rescued those baby girls and took them home. It was the Christian that went into the city when the plague came and everybody is running out of the city to let the sick die alone. And they went in there and they cared for them. You see, the powerful taking care of the weak only makes sense if you have a worldview that says every single person has intrinsic value and they are worth saving. And by the way, this came before the New Testament. Even in our Old Testament, we have these kinds of statements. He who oppresses the poor shows contempt for God, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God. Here's the world we live in. We live in a secular world that wants to champion the idea of justice and individual worth while they destroy the belief system that created those very values. You don't need God to know what is, but you do need God to imagine and long for what ought to be. Now, I'm not bringing any of this up to minimize any individual person's struggle. If you have wondered ever if it would be easier to just stop believing in God, I'm not trying to make light of that. I am just saying that our ideas have consequences, and you have to think through the world that you would create if you decide to eliminate God in order to eliminate your struggle at faith. That's what happened to Andrea Dilley. She was the daughter of medical missionaries in Kenya. She grew up in the slums of Nairobi. She saw incredible injustices and suffering and pain. And as a young teenage girl, she became so angry at God for the things that she continually saw. Finally, in her 20s, she just gave up faith in God completely. And so she says she was having a conversation one day with a young man who was arguing that all morality is just self-created, that there really is no objective morality. Every culture decides for itself what is right and what is wrong. And she found herself saying, but are you saying it's wrong to say that Hitler was evil? Are you saying that we can't condemn a culture that would let babies starve to death? Are you saying that we can never call something evil? It seems to me that we have to live with some higher objective standard of what is right or wrong if we want to have a just world. And she realized Even as I spoke those words, I was arguing for God. And she writes, when people ask me what drove me out of the doors of the church and then what brought me back, my answer to both questions is the same. I left the church in part because I was mad at God about human suffering and injustice. And I came back to church because of that very struggle. I realized I could not even talk about justice without standing inside a theistic framework. In a naturalistic worldview, a parentless orphan in the slums of Nairobi can only be explained in terms of survival of the fittest, where we're all just animals slumming it. In that worldview, it is just a godless world where we all are simply fighting for space and resources, and the idea of justice doesn't mean anything. But she concludes, to talk about justice, you have to talk about objective morality. And to talk about objective morality, you've got to talk about God. And so, if you are having a faith crisis, I am asking you to consider that deciding that there is no God is not the best path. A better path is to decide to get to know God. Maybe the God that you are mad at, maybe the God that you are disappointed in, maybe that God is a distortion of the true God. God is the victim of a lot of bad translations. So my goal in this series is not to take these really hard questions and tie them up in neat little packages and put a bow on them and say, see, you don't have to think anymore. That's not my goal. My goal is to increase your resolve to trust God, even when you cannot understand all of it. And that means two things as we move forward. To know God requires the need for honesty. Remember, God wants people to love him with their minds. And so that means that the church has got to stop treating hard questions like toxic waste. We can't tell people. Jesus never flinched when a truth seeker asked a tough question. We need to be a safe place for people to admit that they've got some doubts. I had more than one person respond when they told me their faith struggle. I've never shared this with anybody, and it really bothered me. And it bothers me that you don't think you can share it with anybody. Remember Thomas? The disciples said, we've seen Jesus. He's been raised from the dead. Thomas said, I don't think so. And the disciples did not respond to Thomas by saying, get out of here, you doubter. And a week later, when Jesus showed up and Thomas did then believe, he would have missed Jesus if the community of faith had told him, you can't come back here until you're thinking right. There's a very powerful little short verse. The brother of Jesus wrote this. Jude, verse 22, says, be merciful to those who doubt. Don't pounce on them. Don't fight with a person who's already wrestling. Mike McCarb wrote a book where he shared that he walked away from God because of science. Now, eventually his study of science actually led him back to God, but in that space of several years where he did not believe in God, he talked about being afraid to ever tell anybody what he was really thinking, especially his family. And he argued that one of the things that brought him back to faith was the mercy that his family showed him when he was honest. I want to share a short paragraph from his book. He said, if you're a Christian who wonders what to do with someone who is in doubt, consider this carefully. Love and grace speak loudly. The first and best response to someone whose faith is unraveling is a hug. My path back to God was paved by grace, by those who received my doubt in love. Let's be a place where people can be honest about their doubts. But let me step on a toe or two, because it works both ways. You need to be honest about your doubts, but you also need to be honest about why you are doubting. Because some people use doubt as a dodge. In other words, some people conclude, I don't want to believe in God because they are living a life that they know they will have to give up if they claim faith in Jesus. And I think that's a fair question to ask. Is doubt camouflaging a heart that doesn't want to submit to God? God doesn't mind if you wrestle. God's merciful. God won't crush you. But you know that if you wrestle with God, you must ultimately concede. And so the other thing that we have to bring to the table is humility. You see, to know God requires the need for humility. You are never going to know God completely. God is always bigger than your intellect. Isaiah 55, verse 9, which was read at the beginning of the service, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Paul said in the book of Romans, verse 33 in chapter 11, oh, how great are God's riches and wisdom and knowledge, how impossible it is for us to understand his decisions and his ways. Again, God wants to be loved with your mind. I'm not saying that faith is anti-intellectual. I'm acknowledging that God is beyond finite intellect. I'm saying that complete understanding is not necessary to have a strong, vital faith. Think about it. If God was so small that somebody like me could explain him completely, then he is not big enough for people like you to worship. Are we humble enough to reach a place where we can bow before a God that we will never figure out? Because the struggle for faith at some point is also going to be a struggle with pride. Behind a lot of doubt is an assumption. If I was God, I could do a lot better. Isn't that true? We all think that if we wrote God's job description that we would change it. It's not so much that we say that there is no God. It is that we say, I'm not sure that I like the God that I know. If I was God, there would have not been a tree in that garden in the first place. If I was God, there never would have been a serpent. If I was God, there wouldn't be any suffering in this world. If I was God, there would be no hell. And deep down, we're saying, God, you're not doing your job right. You see, but what about is often about the character of God. And the best answer I can give to that question is, but what about Jesus? Why doesn't God clear up all the fog and just make himself clear? He very much did do just that. The Hebrew writer said that the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. You see, Jesus is like God. We all know that. But have you ever thought that God is like Jesus? He is the kind of God that comes back for Thomas. He is the kind of God that heals the son of a father who admits that he's struggling with unbelief. He's the kind of God that comes after people who have so many, but what about? And so at the end of the day, I don't believe because I've got everything intellectually solved. I believe because I have come to trust in the God that I see revealed in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. If you and I were God, there never would have been a cross. Heaven had a, but what about? What about their sin? What about their rebellion? And heaven's answer was for God to become like you and me. He went to a place he didn't deserve to go, to die a death he didn't deserve to die, to save a people that didn't deserve it. And it doesn't answer every question, but it certainly does answer this one question. Does God love me? Because at the end of the day, faith is not a belief in a statement or in an answer to a question. It is trust in a person. And I have seen enough of God in Jesus to decide, I do believe. Would you stand up? I want to pray with you. Father, we are diving into some deep water, and we need some help. We need to be honest. We need to be real. We need to be humble. And my prayer for our church, and even for me as the preacher, is not that I will wow people with intellect, but that I will inspire people to see the goodness of Jesus. He is our cornerstone. And when we don't know where to stand, we can stand there. And when we are weak, He is strong for us. So give us wisdom, Lord, and give us truth. In Jesus' name.